right, good afternoon, everyone. We're back in session. Carla, could you please read item number 945?
Yes. Amend the comprehensive plan map, zoning map, Title 33, Planning and Zoning, Title 18, Noise Control, Title 32, Signs and Related Regulations, to revise the multi-dwelling residential designations and base zones.
All right, so I'm gonna break the good news and the bad news. The good news is you're all here and you look great. The bad news is we have 47 people who would like to testify, which is fantastic. We like to have that kind of community engagement, but realistically, we're not going to get through all of the testimony today. And I just want you to be aware of that possibility. My colleagues and I have said we will stay till 6 p.m. tonight. Then we have other commitments, but it's possible we won't be able to get everybody in today. And if that is the case, what we'll do is we'll set aside another time when those who have signed up who didn't get to testify get to go to the front of the line and testify first. So everybody will have that opportunity. If people decide they can't come back and they'd still like to submit testimony, we'll of course take written testimony if you don't get to speak today. But we've decided it's better to let everybody speak for 3 minutes, have their full say on this, then cut everybody short and try to cram it in, because even if we cut it short, I don't think we're going to be able to finish it today. So with that, item number 945. This afternoon, we're holding a public hearing on the Better Housing by Design recommended draft. Better Housing by Design is a key element of the Housing Opportunity Initiative, which is a suite of proposed actions to allow more types of housing that more people can afford to live in here in Portland. To help reorient everybody to the proposal, Better Housing by Design applies to land zoned for multi-dwelling. That's everything from two-story townhouses to 10-story high-rises outside of the central city area. And while only about 8% of the city is zoned for multi-dwelling, this zoning is in locations close to services, and it's close to transit, and it plays an important role in meeting our climate action plan goals. Better Housing by Design is intended to create climate-smart communities by enabling more people who can live within walking distance of commercial services and transit. Better Housing by Design is also intended to benefit working Portlanders, families, and people of color. The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff is going to start us off today by providing a short presentation on Better Housing by Design. We'll then hear from the chair of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, Catherine Schultz. I want to recognize, first of all, the great work that the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability has been doing and the staff, especially our Better Housing by Design project manager, Bill Cunningham, and our Planning and Sustainability Commission. We thank them. I commend the Bureau's work in gathering feedback from our community in order to develop and update this important proposal. The proposals help accelerate the construction of more affordable housing by offering incentives and bonuses so that different housing options are available for more Portlanders at all income levels. Director Durbin, I'll ask you to come up now. I'll turn it over to you and your staff before we open it up to public testimony. And just by way of housekeeping, since there are only three of us, none of us can leave the room. And so what we're going to do in order to maintain the quorum is in about an hour or so, we'll take a brief break and then we'll come back and everybody will have a chance to stand up and stretch a bit.
Unless nature requires it earlier time.
In which case, just raise your hand. Director Durbin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mayor, members of the City Council. My name is Andrea Durbin, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We appreciate being here today and having an opportunity to hear public testimony. Over the last few years, we have rewritten the zoning codes for the full spectrum of Portland's residential development. We started with our fast-growing mixed-use centers and corridors, and then addressed central city housing. Now, through the Housing Opportunities Initiative, we are rewriting the rest, the multifamily housing, and later this year, single-family dwelling zones. The goal of these zoning code changes is, one, to encourage the production of more and better housing, Two, to increase the range of housing choices, sizes, prices, and locations. Three, to encourage more housing in places that already have the services and amenities that benefit households, including along transit corridors. Fourth, to increase through bonuses the supply of affordable housing produced with new development. And lastly, to the best of our ability, to manage the risk of displacement from new development and growth by developing proactive strategies to support people staying in their neighborhoods. Better Housing by Design does this for multifamily housing, and this is where we will see most of our growth now through 2035. So with that, I am going to introduce Bill Cunningham, who's the BPS lead for this, and he'll give a quick recap of this proposal.
Thank you, Andrea. I'm Bill Cunningham, project manager for the Better Housing by Design project. We will give a very brief presentation on the proposal so we can have time for the testimony. I wanted to first start out by providing some context for the code amendments that are before you. One issue we need to be aware of is that Portland is a growing city. We anticipate around 100,000 more households between now and 2035. And Portland's households have changed over the years. Back in 1920, when our inner neighborhoods were in the midst of being built, the average household size is about 4.5 people. Now it's about 2.5 people. So smaller households, in fact, about 68% of our households are just 1 and 2 people. We also have an increasing income gap. We have increases in high-paying jobs, increases in low-paying jobs. So that creates critical issues related to housing affordability. We have an aging population, and that raises new issues in terms of the accessibility of our neighborhoods and our housing so that people can stay in their communities as they age. I'm not going to get into a whole lot of detail, but income issues, I provided a handout that has some more information, but we wanted to give people some sense as to what we mean when we talk about affordable housing, or what's affordable to people of various incomes. This on the screen, we have a number of income ranges from very low income up to 30% of the area median income. That includes a lot of retirees and fixed retirement incomes. An area of affordability that we're particularly focusing on is the up to 60% of area median income. And for a single person, that's someone earning around $37,000 a year. It's about $17 or $18 an hour. And the people who are earning that include preschool teachers, nursing assistants, groundskeepers. So they're
One moment, Commissioner Hardesty.
I just can't help but say thank you for this. I ask for this all the time. Because you're right, we throw around this term affordable housing as if affordable housing is the same for everybody, right? So thank you. This is a clear picture that helps me decide what's affordable for me.
And if Great. I could just add that the thanks goes to the Housing Bureau who provided this graphic for us.
Thank them for me too.
Yes.
I always want this. I'm going to put this on my wall. Maybe I'll find it because it's a good model. Thank you.
Yep. The thing we wanted to highlight for that 60% of area median income, when people talk about low income, you know, what does it mean? And it's people pretty critical to our city. Again, the preschool teachers, nurses, assistants, many working class people. 80% AMI, or area of median income, it varies depending on household size, but you're in that income level if you have two minimum wage income earners paying together into housing. So that's something to be aware of. One issue, too, is that what's considered affordable for that nursing assistant or preschool teacher is about $945 a month, but the average one-bedroom rent in Portland now is over $1,300 a month. So for these working-class people, increasingly, we don't have housing that's affordable to them, and that's something to bear in mind when we're talking about our proposals. Another dimension of affordability is looking at the cost of houses. The image on the left is showing in blue dots what house sales were affordable to the average Portlander back in 2000. And back then, all those blue dots represent houses that were affordable to a median income household. Today, looking over to the right, the brown orange dots show what is not affordable. So you can see that much of the houses that have been sold are not affordable to your average Portlander. You have bits and pieces in East Portland, but not many.
Commissioner Hershey.
Thank you. You know, we trade terms like on this handout is AMI, on this one it is MFI.
Yeah.
And it's really hard for the public to understand what the heck we're talking about when we switch back and forwards. And so I know median family income, and is that specifically in the city of Portland, or what is MFI?
The area median income is based on regional amounts, so it's not specific just to Portland, it's for the Portland region. And the house, the federal government HUD sets some of those numbers.
Let me just recommend that you either use one or the other rather than interchanging them going back and forwards.
No, I apologize about that. We're more frequently calling it area median income, and this is an old diagram. But the basic message is houses are out of reach for the majority of Portlanders now. And knowing that we have a broad range of household types, we know we need a broader range of housing opportunities for people. One thing we also know is that housing production hasn't kept up with the growth in the numbers of households in Portland. So more people vying for not enough housing does drive prices up.
I just wanted to make a comment. I couldn't Google it quite so fast because I was really surprised to see that the example for $74,000 was an elementary school teacher, because my daughter-in-law is one, and that she doesn't make sense. So the range for a Portland public school teacher is $49,000 to $72,000. So depending on your age, and I think this is part of the point you were making as well, that we've got an aging population, but then on the other hand, we've got young people who are just starting in their careers, who maybe are just starting families as well. So we need a whole range of different kinds of options.
Yes, this is the danger of having a simple diagram, because disclosure, my wife is a school teacher, and I know that if you're starting out as an elementary school teacher, you're probably not earning that much. Moving on, so that's some of the context, the lack of affordability, smaller households. One issue to be aware of is this project's focusing on the multi-dwelling zones in Portland. It's only 8% of the city's land area. And in this diagram, it's showing in blue where the multifamily zones are. Red is showing where commercial zones are. So it's a tiny part of the city, but you can kind of see it's coursing along our corridors. So 86% of our multi-dwelling zoning is within a quarter mile of transit streets, and much of it is also close to our commercial services. So it's pretty key to our climate action plan goals for allowing more people to be living within walking distance of where services are, where transit is, so you have more options for getting around with not necessarily being dependent on driving. Want to highlight the general approach of the project. There are two major approaches that are part of this proposal. One is really about expanding housing options for all sorts of households. It's about expanding the diversity of our housing types in the multi-dwelling zones, and a key part is addressing affordability, knowing that that's a critical issue at this time. We're not only thinking about numbers in terms of numbers of units, it's about improving the design, making sure that when we have housing, it supports the livability of people living there, and it also supports our community objectives for integrating development with neighborhoods, providing walkable neighborhoods where it's easy to walk around. So that's something to bear in mind. It's a general approach is we're providing more flexibility for more units on our typical multi-dwelling sites, but there's a big focus on the way that's designed. One example of what we're doing related to housing diversity is these sets of images are showing some pre-1950s multifamily in Portland housing. And Portland had a pretty diverse array of housing back before modern zoning came in. They're predominantly fairly low-rise. One issue, though, is in our most common zone, the current R2 zone, only the duplex could be built. It's a zone intended for low-rise development, but the eightplex and the courtyard apartments can only be built in about a small minority, about 8% of our multifamily zoning. We're proposing to bring back some of those possibilities to regulate by the scale For having a low-rise zone intended to be about a fairly neighborhood scale, all these would typically be allowed.
I don't understand that, Bill. Could you just explain that more? Because you can do, if you've got big enough sites in the R2 zone, you can have as many units as you've got site area for.
Yes, that's true, but the densities we have here, which are fairly small lots, could not be built in our multi-dwelling zones.
So that's what you're proposing to change, is the density rather than
right, the
necessarily
scale
the housing type.
Right, the same, but there's more flexibility for the housing types. And this does relate to affordability. The next slide is highlighting what's typically built in our close-in neighborhoods in our most common zone, the R2 zone. And on a 5,000 square foot lot, for example, your maximum density is a pair of units. And typically, you're getting a pair of attached houses, row houses. You know, they're an important urban housing type, but they become very inexpensive and very expensive in Portland. You're talking to $500,000-$600,000, sometimes $700,000, depending on how large they are. And so that's really serving a pretty small span of our community in terms of who benefits from that zoning. You're going to have a lot of money. It's probably at least 150% of AMI. Now, the amendments would, in these low-rise zones, allow more units. And the example on the right is showing six 1,000-square-foot units on the same size site as others. It's a corner lot, 5,000 square feet. And these are $380,000 compared to this $600,000 or so. And this becomes affordable to an average income or slightly below average income two-person working household. That square footage actually happens to be about the same size as the Cape Cods that were built after World War II that actually did accommodate families. So that's the critical piece here. The idea is we'd be opening things up for other mixes of low-rise housing.
Just for just a sec.
Commissioner Fritz, then Commissioner.
The price per square foot is more on the townhouses. And I agree, because my first home here was about that size of square foot, and we grew out of it as our family expanded. So I think that's really important. I want to make sure that we're going to have family housing in Portland as well as affordable housing. I don't think the two should be exclusive.
A key thing about the proposals to bear in mind is you would still be able to do these smaller numbers of attached housing development, but we would be opening up allowances so you could do other types as well. So that's something, and we did some economic analysis. Basically, both smaller unit types and larger unit types would be economically feasible. So with the changes, we'd probably see a mix of both these types. But the main move is opening opportunities so you could have greater numbers of smaller units along with the large townhouse development that typically gets built today.
Well, if I'm a developer, I'm going to go for 6 at 380 because that gets me nearly 20,000. Two million, whereas the two of the larger ones gets me half that.
There's a lot of money to be made for expensive attached housing. So it's in terms of a square foot cost of construction and profit, they're not that different. It starts getting different when you do have more studio or very small units. But what we've seen up to now in the zones that allow this broad range, we get a mix of all the types. Just one issue is those townhouses. They're in the RH zone. Those six units on that 5,000 square foot site could only be built in that highest density RH zone. That could not currently be built in our low rise multifamily zones. So this would change things and open up basically the spectrum of people who could benefit from new housing in those zones.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. So I have seen houses in Inner Northeast that are these teeny tiny townhouses that start between $600,000 and $800,000, and that's before we make any changes to zone. What's to prevent, I think as Commissioner Fritz alluded to, that all of these six units would end up being $800,000 or more? What would prevent that?
Based on the economics, it simply pencils out to do less expensive units. All the analysis we've done in terms of how much do smaller units cost in the same area compared to larger units.
But you're missing my question. So if I'm a developer, it may make sense for me to build cheaper units, but it may not make sense for me to sell cheaper units. So again, I could build it cheaper because I can now build six where I was only building two. But what's to prevent me from charging as much money as I think I could possibly get from that unit? Who would stop me from doing that? Because again, I see these sizes right now in the inner Northeast, and they are on the market for $800,000. And I don't know who these people are, but people are buying them.
Right. That's a good question. We can't entirely control what the market might do. We've heard from some builders is that because of land costs and the limited number of units you could do, they have very little choice but to do very expensive units. Having a broader range of units does create a situation where a broader range of potential buyers could be customers for that housing. I do want to highlight that one thing that this project does too is related to development bonuses. In all the zones, there's a constraint on what you could do in terms of by right base scale allowances. And what this project...
I'm sorry, would you repeat? Did you say something about developer bonuses?
Yes, I was about to talk about some of the bonuses that are more directly tied to providing affordable units. We have basically a base entitlement where in any of our zones, there's a limitation for what scale you could provide. And if you want to go to a larger scale, and for example, in our corridors, you could not really get to a full four-story scale unless you use development bonuses. And those development bonuses are tied to basically outcomes that implement our policy objectives. And the primary way you get to a bigger scale is providing affordable units. We're increasing our inclusionary housing bonuses for affordable housing, which provides housing affordable at 60-80% of area median income. But the greatest bonuses, the biggest priority bonuses, are really aiming at that 60% of area median income. These are things that more directly get beyond just what the private sector might do, but link to ensuring that affordable units are included when you go bigger with development. And we did some economic analysis about this too, and it indicated that if you're going bigger and you're including inclusionary housing, even at 60% of area median income, it pencils out at these low-rise densities. It's economically feasible. Also wanted to highlight that we know that it can be difficult to fit three-bedroom family housing bonuses in these compact sites. So there is a bonus, too, that's oriented towards three bedrooms that are affordable at moderate incomes. So that would be something where we're prioritizing development outcomes that are more affordable. We also have an allowance where if you commit to preserving existing affordable housing, sometimes what people call naturally occurring housing, you could transfer development rights to another site, go bigger elsewhere. So there's a linkage to preserving affordable housing. Another thing that we have is a bonus through which if you're providing accessible units and of course helping to meet the needs of our aging population, disabled population, you would get some bonus to help encourage that. Most of our permits in our multi-dwelling zones don't require accessibility, so we're looking at some tools that can increase the physical accessibility. But the biggest priority is getting affordable housing in. So generally, commissioners, there's allowance for a broad range of unit configurations for without strings attached. But if you want to go bigger, it's tied to delivering on affordability, accessibility, key priorities like that. Going to move on to the components that are more about the design side of things. One thing we're doing is expanding some of our outdoor space requirements, including requiring common areas, courtyards for large sites. And this really relates to things we heard in terms of outreach that had happened with tenants, with residents of multifamily. These are important things for especially families. One thing we've been trying to address is a lot of people assume that apartments only have single people living in them. East Portland especially, there are a lot of families with kids. The numbers we have show that about half of our Hispanic and African American communities have families living in apartments. So can't assume that apartments don't have families. And one of the ideas, as more people live in multifamily, you know, with houses being out of reach, The thought is everyone should have access to outdoor space. You shouldn't have to afford a house to be able to have access to outdoor space. There's also a new flexibility for parking. It's optional in more cases. Building design and scale is another thing that's being paid attention to. There's greater limits on front garages and tying in the design of buildings to typical neighborhood context. So part of the idea is we'll be getting more development in these areas, but we want them to contribute to our design goals for pedestrian-oriented neighborhoods. And there also are transitions when you have the higher density zones next to single-family zones. Another key component is related to East Portland, where we had a particular focus. It's an area of town that hasn't always had a lot of focus, and we're really trying to have regulations that responded to some of the strengths of the area. And one proposal is to keep the centers of the area's large blocks more open. That's often where the Douglas fir groves are. There's also regulations intended to facilitate street connections, which are sorely lacking in that part of town. So as development happens in the multi-dwelling zones, we'd be expanding options for getting street or pedestrian connections in there. We also have several changes related to historic districts and right-sizing the zoning so that the base and bonus scale is roughly in alignment with the scale of larger historic buildings in the area. There's some changes to our zoning mapping to achieve this, as well as other regulations. In some cases, we're reducing the scale somewhat. Other cases, we're actually increasing the allowed scale. In fact, that historic building on the right is in an area where the multi-dwelling zoning only allowed buildings of about half that scale. So there's a right sizing that happened here in the highest density multi-dwelling zones in historic districts. Just to wrap up here, again, the two major things we're doing is expanding housing options, greater diversity of unit types, focus on affordability, but also focusing on design. And that's what we have, and I'll turn it over to Andrea.
Great. Thank you, Bill. And next, I want to introduce Daisy Quinones, who's the commissioner from the Planning and Sustainability Commission.
Hello.
Hi.
All right. Dear City Commissioners, Mayor Wheeler, again, my name is Daisy Quinones. I'm the youth commissioner appointed to the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Thank you for having me today to speak on Better Housing by Design. Just a little heads up, I'm feeling a little under the weather, so if you hear some sniffles, I apologize. The Planning and Sustainability Commission is pleased to forward our Better Housing by Design recommended draft. The Better Housing by Design zoning code amendments make fundamental changes to Portland's multi-dwelling zones that will help our city meet its future housing needs, including new incentives that prioritize affordable housing. Better Housing by Design works together with Residential Infill Project as part of a broader housing opportunities initiative to update the zoning code to expand housing options and address housing affordability while developing strategies to minimize displacement. We at the Planning and Sustainability Commission believe that development in multi-dwelling zones is important for allowing more people to live close to services and transit, and the proposals included include appropriate mitigation measures that will help address Portland's need for affordable housing, especially for low-income households here in Portland who face the greatest challenges finding housing that they can afford. As someone who grew up living in apartment complexes in East Portland, I'm really excited about the changes Better Housing by Design aims to bring. I'll speak to two today really briefly. First, Better Housing by Design, as mentioned, will increase the diversity of housing options in our multi-dwelling zones through incentivizing the development of affordable units. This will help create housing and keep housing affordable for families such as my own growing up. Secondly, I'd like to share, as a kid growing up, my friends and I often found ourselves playing in the parking area of our apartment complexes, which was quite dangerous if you think about it. There was little recreational space either within our unit or in the complex. And also, our parents were often really hesitant to let us walk to the park, either because we would have to cross major roads like 122nd Avenue, or we would have to walk along roads that lacked sidewalks. Unfortunately, There's still quite a lack of sidewalks in East Portland today, but that's a topic for another day. Better Housing by Design's outdoor space and green element standards will create spaces for play, recreation, fresh air, and outdoor enjoyment to the many current and future Portland families who choose to or have no option other than to live in our multifamily dwelling zones. The Planning and Sustainability Commission recommends the Better Housing by Design zoning code and map amendments to help meet the housing needs of Portlanders and will advance our city's equity objectives. These amendments provide new regulatory tools that will help expand our housing options, facilitate the development of affordable housing, foster design and outdoor spaces that support quality living environments for residents, and provide new tools for creating needed street connections in areas that lack them, such as East Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to participate as part of the review of this project and for considering our recommendations.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate it. Next up, we I sort of got it wrong on the logistics of today's run of show. So I indicated there were 47 people signed up. Quite a few of them are actually on invited panels, so there was some overlap here, and I apologize for that.
Excuse me, Mayor.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Just before you call the next panel up, I just want to appreciate our youth representative on the commission. I wish I had been that poised and that knowledgeable when I was a young person. It just absolutely fascinates me, your grasp of what the issue is and how it's going to impact folks in our community. I live in East Portland as well. And so I just couldn't let you leave without saying thank you so much for your willingness to serve and for your clear understanding of what the issues are and what the challenges are. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And the rest of you were great, too, but I just had to.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner. We appreciate it. Next up, we're going to hear from some other city commissions. Daniel Newberry from the Urban Forestry Commission and Kristen Miner from the Historic Landmarks Commission. You're our next panel. Thanks for being here.
I'm curious if we're going to hear about the report that was done. I kind of feel like we're doing this backwards. There was an excellent study done by the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability on a historic context of racist planning in the city of Portland. So I'm just kind of wondering where that is on the agenda.
Director Durbin.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Commissioner. Our plan is actually to bring that report when we bring residential infill and the discussions, which will start in December, because the report that we just issued, Racist History of Zoning in Portland, really looks at the single-family dwelling zones. And so that'll be the conversation we will start when we bring that code package up, zoning package change in December.
That's unfortunate, because I actually think that your report is an excellent report. My first question was, did you tell the truth? And when you read the report, it is clear you did. I think that report actually is the frame under which all the actions that we're taking around housing over the next few months, this is actually the frame as to why we're doing all the stuff that we're doing. So I think it may be a missed opportunity for those who are here today that we're not setting the context for why are we doing this.
Yes. Well, we certainly, through Better Housing by Design, we are addressing some of the inequities that we're seeing in the city from this history, particularly looking at affordable housing option and providing more opportunities and different additional units and developments and multifamily in the multifamily zones. I appreciate that. We appreciate your recognition of this report. Our staff did a great job of working on this. We do want to have that conversation with the council when we talk about residential infill, because it really provides kind of the basis for the history of the single-family dwelling zones and how they were established and how they've been spread across the city and why we need to make changes to them today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Could I ask just a procedural question? You mentioned 3 minutes per testimony. On the website, it said 2 minutes.
I'm not sure why that would be. Historically, what we do is we offer people 3 minutes, and if we don't have time, we'll cut it to two. And if we're really desperate, we'll cut it down to one. But this is such an important issue, and we're not particularly rushed in terms of needing to get these plans approved anytime soon. And so we, you know, on balance, we just think it would be better to give people a little extra time, that
Good.
3 minutes.
Talk more slowly.
But,
yes.
But I will say this. If somebody says something you've already said, you don't need to go into depth. You can just say, like, whoever said, I agree on X, and move to the next point.
Yep.
You bet.
Please.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you, members of the Portland City Council. My name is Daniel Newberry, Policy Committee Chair for the City's Urban Forestry Commission, and I also live in East Portland, like many of the other people here today. First, we'd like to thank Bureau of Planning Sustainability and Planning Planner Bill Cunningham in particular for including many of our requests for changes into the current draft. As affordable housing is a major goal of this plan, it's important that low-income residents enjoy the health and heat island reduction benefits trees provide at home, as do Portland's wealthier residents, many of whom live in tree-rich neighborhoods. We can have both affordable housing and large trees in our city. Please do not approve additional exemptions from tree planting and preservation requirements for affordable housing reasons. Title 11 exempts affordable housing projects from the tree preservation and planting standards that most other development projects must meet. These exemptions further exacerbate the inequities associated with tree-deficient neighborhoods. This really is an issue of equity. Limiting impervious area in development situations is important for preserving future space for large form trees and for protecting existing trees. We like the provision of limited asphalted parking area to 15% of the site, and we urge the City Council more broadly to enact impervious surface limitations that would apply to future developments in all zones and plans. We are concerned about the proposed flexible landscaping provisions with the requirement that at least 50% of the landscaping be in ground. We fear that these provisions will further encourage the payment of fees in lieu of tree preservation and planting that are allowed by Title 11. However, we could support the proposal with an additional requirement that Title 11 tree density standards are met by planting trees rather than simply just paying in lieu fees of tree planting. We support the proposal to allow transfer development rights to protect trees. This mechanism does have the potential to save existing large trees, so the Urban Forestry Commission supports these development rights as long as they do not otherwise limit space for large form trees. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on Better Housing by Design and for adding elements to the plan to promote green spaces.
Thanks, Commissioner Newberry. Commissioner Fritz.
Have you sent in your testimony, please?
I can leave this.
Yeah, if somebody could send it to the clerk, or she can.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much. I appreciate everything you had. I took some notes.
Great. Commissioner Minor, welcome.
Thank you so much for allowing me to come as invited testimony. My name is Kristen Minor. I'm the chair of the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission. And I'm here to present a letter from my commission about this project. We have definitely been working on this for some time, just hearing different briefings, and I have to say this project has come a long way, and I want to commend the work that Bill Cunningham and that the PSC has done on this.
And the PSC is the Planning
excuse
and Sustainability.
Me. Thank you so much, Commissioner. I do have a couple of extra copies if any of you would like to follow along, but I'm not going to quote or read from my letter today. I hope that you do take the time to actually read it.
Thank you.
In the interest of time, I am going to skip over quite a number of actually what I consider to be hurrah moments. These are things that are really worth calling out and that are significant and that we support. So my apologies, I am going to skip over to covering a couple of issues that we'd like to raise today. One of those issues is it's kind of in three parts, and on page 2 and 3, I have our concerns listed as bullet points. So starting with bullet point 2, 3, and 4, I'm going to cover those together as the first issue, and those all relate to how the Limericks Commission does its work in historic districts. What we do there is assess a new project in terms of its compatibility with the existing historic pattern, height and scale, and then the finer level details. So regarding that, first, the code does not currently do a very good job of alerting applicants that some projects might not reach their maximum height or bulk if they're not compatible. And so our first point is really that changing terms that are currently maximums in the code to by right or base makes that even less clear for applicants. And so I think what we're asking for is that in historic districts, that there be more alerts or, you know, more kind of provisions in the code that actually specifically mention that you have to meet those compatibility standards. Next, that extra FAR, which is bulk, the bulk of a building, earned by affordable housing projects, I would say that this is not the right incentive to use within historic districts for that very reason, that sometimes it's hard for a project even to meet the maximums, let alone extra that's earned for a project. And so what I would suggest, and what the Landmarks Commission would suggest, that if we have to say no to some extra earned area of bulk, that at least that developer could then incentivize it and transfer it out of the district. I don't want to see us in the position of having to say no to a developer of an affordable housing project and leave them with nothing. So at least that would give them some monetary incentive to transfer out. And then finally, there's a recently added provision in this, what's it called?
Excuse me, so is your recommendation that basically historic districts stay the same and every other part of the city changes? Is that what you're recommending to us?
Not at all. We support increased density in historic districts. The problem is that we look at case-by-case basis. So when we're assessing whether something is going to fit in, we really do have to look at the historic buildings there. And so not every project is going to fit in. We do our best to approve as much bulk and height as we can, but there are going to be projects that just won't fit into a historic district.
Which is why I really wish we'd had the other report first, right? Because, I mean, if you're talking about the context of how we develop land use policy, who benefited from that land use policy, and where we're moving in the future, I am very concerned that we are just solidifying the racially segregated housing policy first, and then we go and talk about, now let's figure out how to not displace people after we've already confirmed that the racist policy is fine and we're just going to keep it status quo. So that's what I'm hearing. And if I'm mishearing, then please share with me what it is I'm missing, because that's what I'm hearing sitting here.
Well, Commissioner, I would suggest that some of our historic districts and conservation districts are exactly those areas where low-income people live. So I'm going to point to the Chinatown, Japantown, for instance, which historically has always been an area where low-income people, immigrants, first landed in our city. And that has quite a few old buildings that are protected because they're in a historic district.
Okay, that's one.
Okay, Elliott is a conservation district. That's part of, you know, the core of Albina that has multiple conservation districts. And so all of those protect buildings that in many cases have nothing to do with white ownership or wealth. Of course, there are wealthy historic districts. We agree with that, but this is kind of across the board. Preservation is not just about being white or wealthy.
Well, but I live in East Portland, right? We're not talking right. about preserving anything in East Portland. We're seeing it as an area of economic opportunity for developers. And so I'm just trying to, and I support a lot of the work that the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is doing. So this is not a criticism of the work. But I feel like this conversation is not happening in the context of how public policy around land use planning has detrimentally impacted communities of color. And so when I hear about let's preserve these historic districts, all I hear is let's just keep status quo in place and, oh, we got a plan for East Portland, which says to me that 10 years from now, people of color will no longer be in East Portland. Right, if that's the only place that we're talking about major development taking place. So I'm just concerned about voting on whether or not the status quo makes sense based on the new vision that we have about how we're moving land use plan. And I do understand the difference between residential and multifamily housing and how few zone, how small that is. So unless we're doing something else fundamentally different, and which would mean historic districts would look different than they look today. Yeah. I don't see how we ever get to the housing goals that we say we have.
So if I might just interject, the
Commissioner Fritz.
Percentage of Portland's total land area in historic or conservation districts is 3%, and the percentage of multifamily zoning in historic or conservation districts is 4%. The Commissioner gave us a couple of examples of areas that if we destroy the Elliott District, for example, if we destroy the Lair Hill District, which is also from immigrant and low-income families, if we provide incentives to get rid of those structures, we're not getting any more of those structures. That's the nature of a historic district, is you cannot replicate this. It's no longer historic if it just looks like what was there before. So I think it's, and I know, actually, I was telling myself I would stop commenting because I know we've got lots of people who want to testify and I'm here to listen to you. So I will stop commenting, but I just wanted to put that in.
I appreciate the complexities that we have to deal with. So I just wanted to just make sure that the record reflected that that's what I hear. So unless I'm missing something, then we're still going to have inequalities built into our land use system at the end of the day. And that troubles me.
Okay. The last thing I wanted to say about the kind of FAR and height issue that is currently proposed in the code or the BHBD is that there's a recently added provision that transfers can be allowed into historic districts. And again, we do see that as increasing confusion, especially when there are going to be those inevitable cases where it's not going to be compatible and we have to say no and it'll increase the numbers of appeals. So we would like to limit that to not allowing into transfers into historic districts. My second sort of overall or major point is that it's really a plea to take sustainability seriously. It is our responsibility to push more adaptive reuse and allow less demolition, especially of older buildings that were constructed of materials made to last over 100 years. So we seek, at a minimum, a penalty for demolishing a contributing building in a historic or conservation district. And I know that this has been talked about as part of both better housing and the residential infill, and it's not currently in better housing. I think this is something that could easily be included, and it would overall cause demolitions to decrease and for us to push more towards adaptive reuse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you both. All right, I have to play microphone cop because I want to get, we have three invited panels that are mostly a subset of the 47 people who signed up. But I want to be respectful of the fact that there's a lot of people who are here who are not on the panels. So I'm going to ask panelists, we really want to hear your input, but can you keep your testimony to 3 minutes? Can you try to make your case as strongly as possible in 3 minutes or less? So we now have invited testimony from people and groups who've been involved in the Better Housing by Design planning process, some people from the very beginning, and many of whom who know what successful implementation looks like. The first group involves people who are involved in building the housing we need. So we have Julie Livingston from Home Forward, Mike Beamer from Green Hammer, and Nick Sabi from Rose Community Development Corporation. He did. Okay, that doesn't surprise me knowing Nick. He's got 25 irons in the fire. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners Fritz and Hardesty. It's very nice to be with you this afternoon. I am representing Home Forward today. I'm a project manager at Home Forward and am a developer of affordable housing. As Bill explained in his presentation, the multi-dwelling zones are well connected to schools, parks, job centers, commercial centers, and multimodal transit. As a result, they are great locations for households of all sizes, all incomes, all phases of life. And Better Housing by Design is a game changer for affordable housing developers. To illustrate the significance of these the impacts of Better Housing by Design, I analyzed the before and after capacity of a five-acre parcel that Home Forward owns in Northeast Portland. And 5 acres is a lot of land. There aren't many parcels of this size in these zones. But this is, in fact, 7 lots that have been aggregated into a single site. The site is currently zoned R2. It will transition to the RM1 when Better Housing by Design is adopted. If this site were to be redeveloped, the base zone density calculation would change. The existing R2 allows a maximum of 115 housing units. The proposed RM1 raises that to 220. And because the new calculation methodology is flexible, this number can be finessed by changing assumptions about unit sizes. A density bonus for inclusionary housing would be available, and Home Forward would certainly provide housing units for households at or below 80% of area median income. The existing R2 bonus allows for a boost to 144 housing units. The proposed RM1 bonus takes that number to 330 housing units. The RM1 offers an additional bonus for deep affordability that isn't available in the R2. Deeply affordable units serve households at or below 60% of area median income. These are units that are largely financed with low-income housing tax credits, and they are the bread and butter of Portland's affordable housing development community. Home Forward would be able to increase density on this site by a further 50% to 440 units if we were to redevelop it. So I've represented Home Forward on the Technical Advisory Committee for the past 3 years, and I'm excited that Better Housing by Design is about to go live. Bill Cunningham has done an excellent job of soliciting and responding to feedback from a great variety of stakeholders. Cultivating affordability and livability have been front and center in his work, and he's been thoughtful and thorough in his evaluation of the galaxy of standards that impact housing development. In addition to density, standards for parking, building height, setbacks, and outdoor and community spaces have been simplified and right-sized. Better Housing by Design is a milestone in the development of prosperous, healthy, equitable, and resilient, and the resilient Portland we all want, a city truly designed for people, and I hope that you are able to support it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mayor. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I'm trying to follow you when you say that you could increase housing if RM1 zoning by 50%. Why would you be able to do that just because of the zone change?
The calculation for density changes significantly when we transition from the existing code to the new code. So right now, density is described as the number of housing units allowed per square footage of site area.
Okay.
In the future, it's a totally different calculation that is based solely on the site area and how it is extruded.
And how tall it is?
Yeah, okay. So the amount of square footage that we can put on the site in the future increases dramatically. How we spend it is up to us. We can build studios, ones, twos, threes. It's just square footage.
And so building at 60% means a family of four would have to make $52,000 a year in order around that, in order to be able to afford a property. A individual would have to make $37,000 a year at 60% of area median income.
Yes, or have a voucher to assist.
And are you anticipating...
If that unit is at 60%, it is possible to build units for lower than 60% of area median income.
If you have vouchers or some other financial
assistance.
Some other
subsidy that supports units at, say, 30% of area median income. Everything Home Forward does is below 60%.
Thank you. That's helpful.
You bet.
Thank you. Hey, Mike.
Hello. My name is Mike Beamer. I'm an architect with Green Hammer, a local design build firm focused on zero energy buildings and missing middle housing. We have followed the development of Better Housing by Design proposal through its evolution and support the proposal. We have analyzed the proposal through multiple case studies and have found the proposed changes have a positive impact. The shift to an FAR-based system allows greater flexibility in the type and number of housing units developed, which will allow for a greater variety of the housing options in these zones while maintaining an appropriate scale. The properties we have studied would be more likely to be developed and would include more housing units, including regulated affordable units, if the proposal is adopted. We support the restructured bonuses, which prioritize affordable housing and family-sized units. We also support the addition of small-scale commercial use on major corridors. We find the overall package of proposals to be well-considered and represent a significant improvement to the zoning code and encourage the council to adopt the package. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you both.
Thank you.
Next group are community partners. We have Doug Armstrong from the East Portland Action Plan, Alan Delator, Vivek Shandas, and Danny Ledesma from the Portland Public Schools. Welcome. Thanks for being here. Sir, would you like to go ahead and start?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm Doug Armstrong, and I'm testifying on behalf of the East Portland Action Plan. As you know, the East Portland Action Plan represents a comprehensive, community-driven effort to promote livability, improve the built environment, and stabilize low-income communities in East Portland. Staff from the BPS have met with EPAP and its committees at every stage of development of Better Housing by Design to ensure that the proposal you're now considering supports your goals and ours for East Portland. BHBD requires new affordable homes for low income and incentives for very low income families, incentivizes the preservation of existing affordable homes, and encourages the creation of more intentionally affordable for sale housing than is typically available in our city. The proposal measures new buildings by FAR, which is something EPAP supports because it encourages development of housing units appropriate to larger families, which is an area of significant unmet need in East Portland. The proposal also supports East Portland families by retaining the current outdoor space requirements. We would like to see a requirement for common areas in all zones in new multi-unit developments. Under BHBD, new apartment projects will include rear setbacks. We would ask that 25% of the rear setback not be allowed to be paved and that 50% of the rear setback should not be allowed to be used as a vehicle use area. The proposal would also support our struggling families by allowing daycares in all multi-dwelling zones. The proposal incentivizes accessibility for residents and visitors, helping seniors and people with disabilities to live independently within the community they currently call home. BHBD includes a number of new design standards that recognize the unique built environment in East Portland, another key piece of the mandate that underlies the East Portland Action Plan. Every element I've mentioned is specifically called out in the East Portland Action Plan, approved by this council more than a decade ago. I have provided you with a matrix, page 2, that shows the relevant sections of the EPAP plan, and it's great to see that the goals identified by our community a decade ago will be given life in the form of new code language. BHBD is not a panacea, and we all know that zoning and design standards can't do everything we want for our community. They won't solve our affordability crisis. Still, these code changes move the needle substantially for East Portland, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. And I have to say, bravo on the matrix. Somebody put a lot of time and energy into that.
We sat down with all the paperwork, as Joanne, I'm sure, is well aware of. We've got a lot of it. And we found many, many points that meshed with what we were trying to do in East County.
Thank
East
you. And thanks for the community barbecue a few weeks ago. That was
fantastic. You're welcome. Next year will be better.
Excellent. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Vivek Chandas. I'm a professor of urban studies and planning at Portland State University, and I direct the Sustaining Urban Places Research Lab. We've been involved with Better Housing by Design from the beginning when we were asked to participate in a project that looked at it scientifically, trying to bring a data lens to it. And so what we did essentially was we started with this idea that the building stock in the city is one of the most essential components for dealing with climate stressors that communities face. And one of the biggest climate stressors that I've been looking at is urban heat in the region. And we found that East Portland gets the double whammy: summertime heat, wintertime floods, and especially communities that have been historically underserved are those that are most disproportionately impacted. And so what we did with Bill Cunningham and the team early on was to essentially use a computational fluid dynamics model.
Say that three times.
Yeah, there you go. Which is an off-the-shelf model designed in Germany and has rarely been applied to any urban developments, particularly in the policy realm. So we really broke some pretty serious research ground in taking the scenarios that Bill and the design team had put together. We digitized those, and we were running these models to basically see what would be the impact on communities in terms of their experience of the temperature during heat waves that are increasing in intensity, frequency, and duration. And what we are finding is that there are several design considerations that would be very beneficial to keeping the temperature, in fact, at or below the higher density levels. This was a breakthrough for not only the field, but it was a real breakthrough for the design team at BPS to see that, yes, we can increase density and also keep temperatures at or even below what it was prior to the development. And so part of what we're seeing in terms of the reduction in surface parking, what we're seeing in terms of the front setbacks, what we're seeing in terms of the preservation of trees on the site is largely based on some of the outputs from these models. And so early on, those discussions were seeded. Those were then taken and taken out to the community. They're in Appendix C, I believe, of the overall Better Housing by Design document. I would be remiss if I didn't say this based on the questions that came up earlier from Commissioner Hardesty, was as part of a different project, we looked at 108 cities across the country, looked at historic redlining maps that were digitized, and we wanted to see what the temperatures were of those areas that were historically redlined, this is over 80 years ago, to what the current temperatures are in those areas in comparison to the areas that weren't redlined. And of the 108 cities, I was absolutely flabbergasted when I found that Portland was number one on that list. The hottest areas of Portland are those areas that were historically redlined. And so not only did the services not make their way into those areas at that time, they're now disproportionately affecting the communities. And with this project, I would like to at least plea to you not only to support it, but to take into consideration climate in all future development projects. Because once these things go in, they're going to be there for 50, 80, 100 years. And what happens to the planet and what happens to the city in 50, 80 to 100 years is going to hit those communities with the least access to the resources the hardest. And so not only did our historical policies affect this, but now what we do going forward will affect this. So I'll stop there. My time's up.
Great points. Thank you. We appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler, City Council, the two commissioners that are here. I want to first commend my colleague at Portland State for great empirical work. I'm going to put on my age-friendly coordinator hat today and not the research hat. I served in the project work group, and I'm really excited to see what's come forward, although I do have some recommendations and a couple criticisms or maybe even suggestions for moving forward. First and foremost, I do feel that the Better Housing by Design project is positioned to move forward equitable and age-friendly policies in the city of Portland. And I do want to note that I'm talking about equity really from this disability accessibility perspective and not the affordability perspective. And to just underscore some of the racial equity kind of lens that's been applied here as well, it's important to note that communities of color and older adults of color in particular have the highest rates of disability. And so when we think about that, the accessible, visitable component is really important. Some aspects of this that's further the comprehensive plan include equitable housing, accessible centers, physically accessible housing, accessible design for all, and aging in place, and importantly, reducing social isolation, which is an issue that I think we don't always talk about. Also, this is furthering the action plan for an age-friendly Portland and improving accessible housing, advancing opportunities for aging in community, creating accessible social spaces, again, reducing social isolation, and improving the age-friendliness of neighborhood centers. I think that it's very important, though, to think about the residential outdoor areas as part of the solution, but uncovered and inaccessible outdoor spaces don't work for everyone. So I just want to encourage us to think about things like covered courtyards and other places for people to convene in the rainy seasons of our kind of region, because the truth is that there are a lot of people who don't want to go out, you know, from about November to February in an outdoor space, that we need places that we can recreate. And I'm going to get to the last point and try to keep this short. While I support this concept of visitable housing and the bonus provision for accessible and visitable housing, it's an incentive-based approach that's not perfect. And so while it is the best tool that we have currently, we as a city need to advance a legislative agenda at the state to address issues of the Oregon Building Code Division and its minimum and maximum codes, or mini-max code standard, that does not allow us here in the city of Portland to think innovatively outside of that box. It's important for us to move forward with the state to say we want a pilot project or some exemption that would allow us to move beyond the constrictions of state code in moving that forward. I hope to be involved with that legislative push in the next year in 2020. And thank you for getting me here. I've got kids I got to pick up, so this is good, well-timed, and I'm going to run out the door after this, so thank you.
Very good. We appreciate your being here, and thanks to East Portland Action Plan, Portland State. We appreciate all your hard work. Commissioner Hardesty, did you have a comment? And there was one more person on this panel. Yes. Great. Come on up. Thanks, gentlemen. It's good to see you.
Hi, Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners Fritz and Commissioner Hardesty. Thank you so much for allowing me to share Portland Public Schools' perspective on this. I think a lot of our educators, our administrators, our families, our parents know instinctively that housing matters to education.
I'm sorry but can you put your name into the record?
Oh, I apologize. I should know better. Danny Ledesma, I'm with Portland Public Schools.
Thanks. Sorry about that.
Sure. That's okay. So, We understand that housing matters to education. Not only do we know this instinctively, and do our parents and families know this, but the preponderance of the research also talks about how beyond location and proximity to schools, the quality of housing, the affordability of housing, the stability of housing plays a significant part of educational performance. Having a safe, stable, affordable home means that students are having to move less often, which not only has an impact on individual students in a classroom, but also on the classroom community where there's less mobility. Students who live in safe and quality housing are less likely to suffer from health hazards, and they're able to be more healthy and to be able to participate in school activities. Students who live closer to their neighborhood schools have a shorter commute time, if you will. They're able to walk to their schools in a safe way, and they'll be able to spend more time on their homework. So we know all these things about the connection between housing and education and health. And we also really appreciate the myriad of ways in which Portland, the City of Portland and Portland Public Schools partner. Over the last 10 months, the Portland Public Schools engaged in a significant visioning process. And during our visioning process, we're very proud of the fact that not only do we have a sort of future-focused graduate portrait that we're looking at. We're the first education district that also has a list of educator essentials as well as system shifts that are needed to achieve the vision that we have for our students. And one of the system shifts that we talk about, and one of the ways that we think that we're sisters in arms with our City of Portland partners, is that one of the items that came out is that we really need to provide flexible, future-focused environments. And plans and decisions about physical environments should be informed by two key perspectives, equity and a focus on the future. And together, these perspectives promote the development of healthy, flexible, inclusive places of learning. So like you, we're really concerned about how the physical environment, the built environment, impacts learning. And so we're really supportive of the Better Housing by Design, because of all the reasons that have been listed before, but I think the two that really sort of stand out to us is the ability and the flexibility to have more outdoor space so that children can play safely. They can sort of be able to encourage and develop all parts of their selves so that they're thinking about not only their learning and emotional, but their physical parts. And then I think the other piece that we're really supportive of is the East Portland standards and the better connectivity. We know that our historically underserved students, or students of color primarily, are disproportionately impacted by displacement, by gentrification, and a lack of affordability in terms of housing. And so the more that we can support students where they're living, we also heard earlier about how students of color primarily live in multifamily dwellings. And so any enhancements to designs to make that more livable for our families and to support the different housing types for the families that are there to support their learning, we're really supportive. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, Danny. Appreciate your testimony. Thanks to PPS for all their work on this. Our final panel today is the Rosewood Initiative in East Portland. We have Jenny Glass, Ken Marks, and Joanna Molina Marcial. Okay, can we do this? We've had a request for a how many minute break? 3 minute break. We're in recess.
That's okay.
Psych.